Hi there, it's Sarah Raymond, and I am beyond excited to share some news with you today. My new book, You Are Not Broken, A Compassionate Guide to Uncovering Inner Wisdom and Transforming Your Life with Hypnotherapy, is now available. This book is a deep dive into the very practices offered here and with my one-on-one clients, combining hypnotherapy, somatic healing, and trauma-informed coaching to help you release those nagging beliefs that tell you you're not enough. It's filled with practical step-by-step exercises designed to transform limiting beliefs and embrace your true whole self. Whether you're struggling with anxiety, perfectionism, or just seeking a deeper sense of self-acceptance, You Are Not Broken offers the tools and insights you need to uncover your inner wisdom and live a more compassionate and fulfilling life. Head over to Amazon and get your copy of You Are Not Broken today. Thank you for your continued support, and I look forward to hearing feedback from this amazing community. Stay curious and compassionate, and remember, you are whole. You are enough.
Hello, everybody. Les Raymond here with the Mindful Movement Podcast. This episode's a little different. I was recently interviewed by my good friend Randall James from the Always Adaptive Podcast, and I thought I would share it with our audience today. Some of this episode talks about my history a little bit, and you may have already heard some of that stuff, but as Randall and I are both personal trainers and we are winding down 2024 here, setting intentions for 2025, we thought it'd be useful to provide some tips and see if that could inspire anybody out there to make any desirable changes they want going into the new year. Always a good time to just check in and reevaluate and redesign how you want to show up in the world in the upcoming year. So I hope that you find some value out of it and enjoy the episode. And I want to thank everybody again for all the support this year and look forward to what 2025 brings. Now, enjoy the conversation.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Always Adaptive Podcast. This time I have a guest again. His name is Les Raymond. He's the owner of CoreWorks Gym. And he has a podcast, the Mindful Movement Podcast. And yeah, he's here. Les, you want to introduce yourself?
Hey, everybody. Randall, it's good to see you. Thanks for having me on your new and exciting podcast.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. So a lot of people don't know this, but Les was actually a mentor of mine. He's in a lot of ways responsible for me being the way that I am. And he taught me a lot. And what is 2013, I had been seeking a coach, personal trainer, and he sort of took me under his wing. And through that process, I don't know what he saw in me, but he saw something and he said, hey, you should be a personal trainer. So I got certified and I actually ended up working for him. And I have to say a lot of my philosophies and the way I view things is actually in a lot of ways responsible. He's responsible for that. And, you know, it means a lot that he's taken some time out of his busy day to be here with us. And this is going to be a New Year's special, seeing as we're both trainers and, you know, Les owns a gym. We're trying to set something up where I'll kind of go through his history because he has quite a decorated history, just like I do, being overweight and drinking and stuff of that nature, but also leave you guys with some tips, some things that we feel are necessary to bring with you into 2025 because the new year's right around the corner. And I'm sure a lot of you guys are kind of planning out your resolutions and how you're going to go about things. And so hopefully you guys can get some gems out of this to help you on your journey.
Awesome. Well, Randall, I'm never too busy to take out time for you. And I could say I learned a lot from you, too, along the way, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, we have butted heads quite a few times. And I think that natural process, you know, both of us kind of grew through that. You know, it's like learning patience and learning communication styles and all that stuff. But I think ultimately it was good to go through that. I mean, not to go off on a tangent, but I remember you and I went to Boston and, you know, I used to smoke cigarettes for those watching and listening. And Les and I had actually went to a workshop for one of the people that was coaching both of us. And we got an argument in the airport about, you know, smoking cigarettes. And my thought at the time was like, you know, I'm young and in shape and I don't really care about cigarettes right now. And, you know, I wasn't thinking logically. And Les and I had a lengthy discussion, but we butted heads pretty intensely. You remember that conversation?
I do. And thinking back on it, I would have handled it a lot differently now. I probably would have been like, can I have one of those cigarettes?
Really? You think so?
No, but I don't know. I wouldn't have been as judgmental. I mean, I was in a phase young and you think what you know is right. And there's some kind of absolute truth out there that you're tapping into and your ego is fooling you, making you think you know things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would have been probably more likely to ask you questions about it than to give shoulds this or you should that I probably did back then.
Yeah, no, I totally relate with that. That's one of the biggest things that I've learned over the years is to not speak in such certain terms about things because, you know, you never know what someone's going through and why they're doing the things they're doing, but also like ask questions. And I think it was Lane Norton that says, like, you can always spot an expert because they say things like, I don't know, or, you know, it depends, or things of that nature. And that's always like, that's gotten me a lot further now, thinking in those terms and talking to people in that way. But yeah, so we're going to go through Les's past a little bit and just get to know him a little bit before we get into the New Year's tips and stuff. But I actually listened to your podcast with Guillaume. Is that how you say his
Guillaume,
name?
Yeah. I yeah, think that's great, how you say it.
Yeah, that was a great podcast, man. I really enjoyed listening to that.
Oh, thanks.
But in that podcast, you mentioned drinking and, you know, your journey of like quitting drinking, how you went through that and all that stuff. So I guess just for the audience, can you say a little bit about how you got into the direction of becoming a personal trainer? What like motivated you? What motivated you to stop drinking? Like, what was that process like?
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So, well, they're adjacent paths. So personal training, I was still drinking heavily then. I started drinking at a really, I wouldn't say really young age, because nowadays I hear kids start drinking really young. I mean, I started at 15 and a half-ish. Now, granted, I do recall the first time I got drunk, I was like 8 at like,
really?
a holiday dinner. It was at a Passover dinner, and you're in these ceremonies where like every 5 minutes there's a reason to take a sip of wine. We're drinking that like trashy fruity wine, and which for an 8-year-old tastes good. And I remember seeing like, are any of the adults watching me drink this? Like, I didn't know what drunk meant. I just knew I wasn't allowed to drink it. And then later I was like, had my arm on the wall in the bathroom to hold myself up while I was taking a leak. And then like passing out on my grandmother's couch. And it wasn't until like years later, I was able to say, oh, I was drunk that day. That was drunk.
Yeah.
But at 15, I started, I was working at a restaurant and in the kitchen. And at the end of the night, like the crew, the servers, the cooks, the dish guy, you know, everybody would just start drinking when they were during the closing time. And you're like cleaning up shop, you know, wiping everything down, sweeping the floor, all that stuff. So there's like maybe 30 minutes to an hour of like close up responsibilities. And one of the of age employees would always like open up like a case of beer or whatever, or like serve everybody a drink they've been working on making or something, like their drink of the week that they're tinkering with or whatever, and get us all to test it. And I didn't know at the time that I was going to be using that. I didn't know at the time that I had stuff to cope with, but I was already 10 years into parents being split up, heavily affected by that, but not to my understanding. And so it was very seamless for me to kind of stay blind to whatever, you know, how I was affected by like kind of a toxic household that I grew up in. I was, I just seamlessly slipped into this great coping mechanism that I grew really fond of. I mean, I loved alcohol. I loved all the different types. I was open-minded about different ways of going about it. You know, there's this vast spectrum of opportunity in the world of alcohol, and I embraced it all. And it served me really well, I think, in many ways, because, you know, I created the ability to help myself survive when there was a lot of shit to deal with. And at the time, I probably wouldn't have known how to deal with it. And I probably needed something to help me pass time and not have to face those things. And then eventually, I got tired of being a drinker, and I didn't want to be a drinker, and I didn't know how to not be a drinker. And this was after 23-ish years of daily drinking. And there were a couple times where I took like a weekend off for, I think I made it like 2 weeks once or twice, but it was a tough thing to finally overcome, and I didn't really know how to do it. Eventually, I realized that the thing that I was really having trouble with was just the confidence in my ability to do it. I couldn't fathom how I was going to get to a point where I was going to just go the rest of my life without drinking, and that just seemed too overwhelming for me. And I tapped into a tool that at the time my wife was teaching me a little bit about, which was hypnosis, and I wind up going the route of working on the confidence issue, using hypnosis as a tool just to like cultivate some confidence in my ability to approach quitting drinking. And then surprisingly, it was really easy. And I just like stopped one day. And I quit a lot of things. That was a hard one. It took a long time. But then once I was ready, it was easy, which was surprising. Whereas other things I've quit, like I was on opiates for a while. And, you know, quitting's not easy. Like the quitting was not easy, which like I don't think there's enough confidence in the world to make it easy to quit an opiate addiction.
Yeah.
But with alcohol, surprisingly, it was once I just decided I can do this, it just happened. And that was kind of cool. And that was well after my, I guess, like health and fitness journey. So I had checked a lot of boxes and I was already active in the field, owning a gym and being a personal trainer. And when I was still drinking, and I don't want to say like I was lying to myself, but, you know, obviously I wasn't doing my best at that role for my clients because I was, you know, still had a lot to work with on myself, I guess. And quitting drinking definitely made me a better trainer. It made me just better in so many ways, better father, better human, better husband. And it allowed me to work on myself more because oftentimes you just don't know what pain you are soothing until you stop soothing it. So like you don't even really know what you're hiding. And then when you quit drinking, you start to get a glimpse of like, oh, this is why I'm drinking.
Yeah.
And then you could start to work through that stuff, you know, whether it's childhood trauma or whatever. And as far as the fitness side, I just never really paid attention to health for a long time. Like I would eat whatever I'd want. Whenever I would want, I just didn't, I never set it aside and said, this is something I value. Just didn't really pay it any attention. And then when my wife was pregnant, like things started to shift and I had gotten pretty unhealthy. And then my wife and mother-in-law signed me up for a 5K. And I remember being pretty upset about it because that's not something I would have done. Mm-hmm. And I took it as a hint or something. I took it as an opportunity. Luckily, I don't know how I got the strength to do this, but I didn't fight back. And then I got myself out the door to like start running. And that was really hard at first. But a few months later, I ran this 5K and a lot of good things happened. And I was like, I don't want to stop this momentum. So I lived in an area where there's this robust running community. And like every week there's a race. Like you never have to go more than 10 minutes to find a race on the weekend. Yeah. And I would just keep signing up for races. So I always had something on the calendar. So I always had a reason to go out that day or the next day to practice. And a lot of good things happened along the way there. And then my father-in-law was an avid like endurance athlete when he was younger. And he would watch the Tour de France and I would watch it with him and he would teach me a little bit about it. And he had this this bike that he rode, this, I want to say locally famous triathlon in the area I grew up in. And he competed in this triathlon on this bike in like 1984. And now we're coming out and it was 2004 at the time. And I've been running and I've been watching cycling and I'm like, I want to do it. And I rode that triathlon with the same bike almost to like honor him in a way that he rode 20 years earlier, which a lot of technology has changed in bikes over those 20 years. So I was riding a dinosaur through this, you know, like this bike had no business being on this race, but it was like a sentimental thing to me. And then I got hooked on that and I did triathlons for about 6 or 7 years, did about 30 or 40 triathlons. And, you know, I wasn't ever really good. I've always been kind of a bigger guy. So I would be pretty good out of the water and pretty good off the bike. And then I'd be like 190 pounds and this like 150 pounder would run by you up a hill, you might as well be walking. But I still got a lot out of it. And then I did all this without really knowing anything about training other than what you get out of like Runner's World magazine or something. There was no all YouTube right. to educate yourself. And I didn't know anything about like movement in general or strength training or its relevancy for the hobbies that I had and the fitness I was going after. And then I just started to broaden my interest in movement more generally. I started taking yoga classes, eventually stumbled upon some really great minds in the strength world. You alluded to a coach that we had in the past, which unfortunately we had a fallout with, but I learned just a tremendous amount from a local coach in Maryland that I would say was probably had such an interesting skill set of being able to apply a concept to a human being in the context of training, and just got I was developing like a quiver with a bunch of arrows in it. Just had a like starting to broaden my toolkit, and then eventually I got my own place and started to deploy those things and kind of pull all the modalities that I had been picking up and apply them in a scaffolding that I could create. And which eventually you also helped too. Like you came around the time that I was, you know, starting to implement these things, these concepts, and then you took to it. And then you were really curious. And even though we battled, you know, you added a lot to that process, and we were able to talk through or debate through some things. And sometimes, you know, those events, like you said, didn't go well. We butt heads a lot. But I think the end product was a lot better. And there were some other trainers involved that had different eyes, that had different insights. Like I remember there was a girl, Christina, that worked with us that had like an artist eye. Mm-hmm. And the three of us could look at a client in the gym and have, I don't want to say different interpretations, but get to a similar place, but through a different way because of the way our eye takes in information. For instance, if you were watching maybe how someone's spine was moving during an activity, I'd be maybe hyper-focused on the spine, trying to see which way it was going. And I remember Christina would see its relationship to space around, like an artist would see like how something sits on a canvas. And together, you know, we all, I think, learned from each other, and the clients really benefited over the years from that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, that's a really good point that you bring up, how people kind of see things through different eyes. You know, me personally, I look at people's feet, you know, and so it's like you can tell a lot about how someone's moving based off what their feet are doing, what their ankles are doing, things like that. So, yeah, that's great. I think you and I have a lot of parallels in our journey. You know, I had this thought. Well, I've had this thought for a really long time about the issues that we struggle with in health and fitness being addiction, coping mechanisms, yes, but also almost like becoming addicted to those coping mechanisms. When you first started getting into fitness, did you find yourself, so like the triathlons, like you did a lot of triathlons in 7 year, 6 or 7 year period, did you find yourself kind of questioning, one, is this actually healthy for me? Am I starting to, you know, broach into the realm of, yes, this is cool and it's fun and high performing is great, but at the same time, am I pushing this too hard? Am I doing too much? Am I addicted to this? Is this actually healthy?
No, I didn't ask that question at all. I would have never known that was a question to even ask. And I mean, there's only trade-offs. There's no activity that could be like, this is healthy. Absolutely. You know, it's because you have to compare it at least to the opportunity cost of what could you be doing instead. I mean, it's not a relevant question almost, but I definitely didn't pay enough attention in life in general or to myself. I didn't have the self-reflection to ask myself, is this an addiction? Should I be concerned about that? Of course it's an addiction. We're all addicts. I mean, it's just to different things. Some of your addictions, ideally your addictions will align with something that you value more honestly, but you're still going to be an addict. I mean, you could say we're addicted to breathing, eating, drinking. Like, of course you are. You're addicted to exercise, Randall. You're addicted to learning.
Yeah. Well, couldn't you say though that breathing is an autonomic activity? Like you can't, you know, obviously you enjoy breathing. You want to keep breathing.
Well, how do you define an addiction? Something you have to do, you can't give in to, you can't over, I mean, you have to give into it. It's got control of you.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think for me, when I think of addiction, it's like something, like you mentioned, there are only trade-offs, you know, like something that starts to take up more time than it should. You know, like I can certainly say throughout the years, I've been addicted to lifting weights where, you know, right now I'm probably training about an hour each time, but I used to train 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and I wouldn't leave feeling good. I would leave feeling beat up and, you know, it wasn't a good feeling. Whereas like now when I leave and I go to work and whatever, I feel really good. I feel energetic. And like, to me, there's like, it's
you're addicted to that feel. You're addicted to feeling that good, energetic feeling though. Sure. They're both addictions. I mean, our brain likes what it's familiar with. Like we do things and then we get a chemical like outcome from the collective activities, behaviors, inputs, whatever. And then that thing that it does is like, we want to do that again. You know, maybe for different reasons, but I still think I drink coffee. It's an addiction. I could stop. I'm not going to. Is an addiction? Right. Yeah. Does it serve me? In many ways, yeah. Possibly it doesn't in some ways. I don't know.
Guess that would be, sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not curious about the answer to that question. Like we're here. I don't really know why we're here. So I'm not going to pretend I know what ultimately we should be doing. I know that I value my health because I know what it's like not to have it. And I know that it's important enough to pay attention. But you could extrapolate that to endless things where you're spending 24 hours a day focused on that and you have no balance in your life. Whether you're exercising, whether you're, maybe it's not eating, I do think eating is an addiction, but if it's eating at a certain time of day, because it's more convenient to do this, it's like we're such habitual creatures. We're just going to do, we're going to do things. I think where a lot of people find themselves creating like excess suffering is that their addictions take over where it's all driven by their mind and they're not watching their mind enough to play a role and intervene and turn the knobs a little bit. Like the value somebody could get by just pausing and maybe creating stillness or asking themselves a question of what you really care about in life, what, you know, something you really value, can dramatically change the addictive behavior. And I think that's something that is kind of missing. And like you said, as the new year comes around, I mean, yeah, it's arbitrary, but the new year just seems to be a good time where you have this like fresh beginning mindset where it's a nice excuse to check in and be like, what do I want this year to be about? And is the things that I'm doing in my life relevant to the things that I really care about if I spend the time thinking about what I care about? And I find most people ultimately want the same things if they think long term enough. Especially regarding in the context of health, like they want to go out on their own terms. They don't want to, let's say, be a burden on kids or whatever. They don't want to go to a nursing home. And there's exceptions to that. But most people on the average kind of want the same thing. But if you think about if they just ask, like, what do I want to do today? Or what do I want to do this week or this month? They'll get a very different answer. But if they say, well, what's the really thing important to me? The important thing is that when I have grandkids, I could like spend time with them. I could get on the floor and play with them. If it snows and I got a shovel, I'm not like spending a week at the chiropractor just because I spent half hour shovel. Like whatever the thing that improves your real quality of life. And those are important questions that like for a long time, I never asked those questions. I was like, oh, there's a race. I do the thing. I wasn't like, is this a good addiction for me? Is this bad for me? I just didn't know how to stop and ask myself any like really relevant question.
So what I'm hearing is that it's not that you, so are you saying that if you could go back with what you know now and your mindset now that would you have asked those questions, or are you saying those questions just aren't useful?
I hope I wouldn't, because I don't have, like, I feel like I've been arrested a bunch of times. I've quit alcohol, cocaine, opiates. I have two amazing kids, amazing wife. That if I didn't have those other endeavors, I don't think I would have that amazing wife and those kids. Like I've had good health. I've lost it. I've regained it. I've learned. I've helped others. I don't know if I'd want to do it a different way. Like, what do you want your life to be? All good? Make just good decisions,
no,
you know?
No, that's
I'm
not
asking you that. Like what do we want? Like, you know, you mentioned like we have a similar journey or path. Like it's a it's a path. Like this life experience is a big roller coaster full of suffering and how you navigate that suffering. And you know, without some suffering, it's hard to acknowledge and be and have the gratitude of coming out of that stuff. So yeah, I don't know if I would. I hope that I wouldn't do it differently. Of course I would, because if I knew different things, because we're always, every moment we live, we're showing up in the world with the cumulative momentum of all the moments prior leading up to that moment. And the only thing you know how to do is to do what you know how to do in that moment. So if you change anything in the back, you know, if anything was different and you knew different things at the time you made a decision, you'd make a different decision.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think for myself, it is a worry to me personally, because I have a really addicting personality. And so sometimes I have to look back on things and kind of, you know, hey, you were doing a little bit too much of that. Now, I'm not saying like things should all be perfect and all that stuff, but I think, you know, going back to the working out thing where you start to hit it a little too hard, where you're starting to enter the realm of injury and you don't really know, but you're so attached to the thing that right. you keep doing it anyway. Like you start to manifest maybe like a little knee thing or a lower back thing, and you're like, oh, it's nothing. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. You know what I mean? And right. so it's like,
but how do you know until you go too far?
I know. And that's the point, right? Like I don't, you know, I just think I really like that you said everything is an addiction, because I agree with that. And it's just to what level. And I guess all I'm trying to say is like there are places, like you mentioned balance, and I think balance is incredibly important. And I think, you know, you should experiment with things, but I just, I guess I'm more on the careful side of things. I try to be, because I just know my history, and I like, when I get something good, I latch onto it, you right. know, and it's, I take it too far in a lot of ways.
Well, you say, well, too far. I mean, you do you. You do you the way you know you to do you. You say you worry a lot about it. So you spend time literally worrying about like the decisions you're making and.
Yeah. And. You know, I don't know that I ever told you this, but, you know, you said you struggled with opiates. I did too, but I actually overdosed twice. And so that was one of those things where I thought when I'm thinking about a substance, alcohol, for example, I don't drink beer. I don't drink rum. I drink vodka and club soda. I've been doing that the exact same way for years and years and years. So I'm very particular about that stuff. And the same thing happened with my opiate use, where it was a very specific amount. And I told myself if I was going to increase, it was going to be by a very specific amount, you know? And so I was like, okay, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. And then it wasn't fine.
Right.
And then I overdosed, you know, but it like crept up on me, the process getting to that point, you know, I thought it was all good. And so that's like, because those two experiences happened to me, I have a hard time, like that is projected onto everything in a lot of ways. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Well, going through all that, do you really still need to add the worry to it? Like you've learned your lessons. Do you still need to worry about your ability to?
I don't know that I have, you know, because it happens with working out too. It happened with running. You know, I had to catch myself with running because I started to, you know, granted, it's a good thing. Obviously, you're better off doing that than the other activities.
Right.
But I constantly see myself like wanting to do more and wanting to do more. And I'm really good at justifying it, you know. But yeah, I mean,
I remember in the gym, you were very meticulous about some things, and I guess it's a slippery slope. Like there's an infinite spectrum of like quality within a given activity or idea. So it's like, well, how far do you want to spend on it? I mean, take it to like an exercise. Let's say you're doing an exercise and let's say you're doing a one leg deadlift, and the way you deadlift on your right leg might be quite a bit different. It's guaranteed to be different than the way you deadlift on your left leg. If you're a human, yeah. It's going to be different. So somebody could argue there's value in getting them both better and moving towards some kind of symmetry, which is an illusion because there will never be symmetry.
Right.
How far down, how much time do you want to spend on that? Because in theory, you could maybe get better if you're valuing that, the idea of symmetry. You know, if you spend 8 hours a day on that every day, you probably make a lot of progress with that. but it's like at what cost? So like, where do you draw the line of like, well, this was enough for this leg, go to the next leg now, and then I'll go to the next exercise. So
yeah,
I mean, it applies in every direction of our life. It's like, just because you like something, you want something, well, there's 24 hours in the day, and we got, you know, 80, 90 years on the planet, probably, give or take. So you want, you know, life's too short to not do the, to like do it the way you want. And it's like, if you already know that you're going to go these routes that you do, where you go down those rabbit holes or you go too far, and you already also know that you have the ability to recognize I've gone too far and then change your course, which is fine. There's no need to worry about yourself doing that.
Yeah.
Like, the worry is some added thing that you're creating between your left and right ear about the possibility of you doing something that you have a history of doing that you're way better off that you've done. Like, you're better off that you know what it's like to feel what it's like overtraining. If you didn't, you might have your clients overtraining.
That's a good point.
If you wind up undertraining, or let's say you get fat, like, you don't necessarily need to worry about that. That you're going to learn something from that, and probably because of your personality and your desire to like serve in some way and help others, you're probably going to help people from that. I mean, think about, have you ever helped somebody because of, let's say, the drug addictions that you've been through?
Yeah.
Imagine, so like, it was already hard going through the drug thing, and then some gift came from that wound that you were able to spread and make the world a better place. It's useful to try to let go of the worry part about it. You know, and it's simple in theory. It's not necessarily easy, but I don't think you need to worry about it. Yeah, I think you're really good at what you do.
Well, thanks, man. No, I agree. And I mean, to your point, it's like, if you haven't gone through something, how can you empathize with people when they're going through something? You know, it's like, you can read all the books, you can have all the certifications, but ultimately, like, if you have two people, one person's life is completely perfect and the other person is like going through a health and fitness journey, that perfect person can't even relate to what that person's going through. And they might have them overtrained because that's what the book says, or they might, you know, just offer them unhealthy nutrition advice because that's what the book says, or just something like that. So it's a good point. I'm with you. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
I mean, if you're a personal trainer and you spend your day in a gym, you can work out as much as you want, you manage your sleep well, you got everything dialed in, but your clientele, I mean, granted, there's people that outside of this box, there's like athletes that spend a lot of time and they're on themselves, they're getting a trainer to just take it to the next level or something. But the bulk of the people coughing up money to get a trainer, you know, these are average people. They're stressed the gills. Like, they are not in the same situation. And you could do real damage if you can't recognize that this person's juggling 50-hour week job, three kids that have like two after-school activities each that they're running around to. You know, maybe they have a parent that has some excess needs that takes their attention. Maybe they have a side business gig. Like, they're juggling so much. And you can't treat, you know, you have to be able to recognize, how do I meet this person where they are? And not, you know, you have to be able to, you know, take a moment and be able to see those things. Because that's like the typical person. I mean, when you're talking about New Year's, kind of, I don't want to say New Year's resolution or New Year's intentions, being around the corner, like, people that have a real history of taking good care of themselves, you know, those aren't the folks that generally need it. It's the people that struggle with how to get off the couch and out of the routine. And, you know, the things that are really useful are like the real low hanging fruit that could be integrated to the average person to improve their life. And it is important to be able to connect with that, even if you don't live that life, and be able to like see that in another. And maybe that's a form of compassion. Like, what is it like for them? Asking that kind of question. Like, I can't just have this person do this, that, and the other. Like, they've never even cooked their own meal in the last decade or whatever.
Right.
What do you want to talk about? You want to talk about exercise movement stuff? You want to talk about New Year's stuff?
That was good. I mean, you mentioned something there. Shoot, I think I lost it, but I should have wrote it down. But yeah, we can get into your New Year's stuff. So I figured, did you bring some things that you thought were important?
I have some ideas. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we can take turns. You know, you say something, we'll discuss. I'll say something, we'll discuss, probably disagree. And I'm just joking. And then we'll just take it from there and we'll go. I mean, I don't have that many, but maybe do three apiece or something like that.
Okay. Well, we still have a good amount of time. Let me lay a little foundation of like context of how I look at, I guess, like movement in general. And this is something I'm, you know, you're probably, I assume you've probably moved on from a lot and added your own stuff to, but just to lay some context of where my mind is, has been over the years. And then how that connects to with like, well, how would I approach entering a new year if I'm trying to make change in my life?
Mm-hmm.
So more broadly, from a movement perspective, just like defining it, and this is not absolute truth. This is just a useful framework. So somebody that's really smart could easily come up with a way to say, well, that's not exactly accurate. That's fine. Right. And they might be right. I'm not saying that they're wrong or whatever, but this is really useful. Movement on some level is like transferring energy through our body in like the form of force. So it requires a certain amount of force to move. Even just standing up still, you have to push down on the ground enough so that your skeleton kind of lines up against gravity and you remain upright. And you need gravity. You need the environmental stimulus to do that. So think about the parameters that we have. We have like this body with a couple legs and trunk, two arms, a neck, a head. And granted, there are people that don't fit that box outside the bell curve. So obviously adjustments, you know, need to be made for some folks. But generally speaking, and we have this environment where we have ground and space, which we have three planes in that we know of, probably some other dimensions we don't know of.
Yeah.
And there's something very unique about being human in the way that we move with those parameters. And if you look out into the animal kingdom, it really stands out where you see animals oftentimes come out of the womb and they're literally like walking around that day or the next day. And we go through this different process. And I think it has to do with how much energy while we're in utero has to go to developing our brain and keeping us small enough that we could get the brain fully cooked and get it enough and ready and still be small enough to get out safely of the womb. But the very fascinating and useful thing that takes place is once we're out, with no adults in our life telling us how to do this, we all do the same shit for like the first year in our life. We all go through some fundamental patterns and stages that wind up translating where we are cultivating certain qualities in this first year of our life that we somehow innately know how to do. And then they translate to all the other things we do later in life, whether they're hobbies or activities or exercises, training, sports, whatever. And there's a lot of usefulness in connecting with these really foundational things, which resemble what babies do. So if you have any time around very small children, infants, it's very interesting to observe because it doesn't matter what continent you're born in or what century you're born in, you still do the same thing. And to me, it's fascinating that nobody's got to tell you how to do it. Surprisingly, it's not the path of least resistance. So for instance, if you watch like a 4 or 5 month old baby go from on their belly to just prop themselves up where their belly's off the ground. So maybe their legs are on the ground, their arms are on the ground, and then they keep their forearms on the ground, but their hips come off the ground. It's kind of like a little baby version of what an adult would think of as a plank, but it looks a little bit different. If you watch a baby go through this, they're shaking. It's hard. And like, how interesting is that? That they are choosing innately to do this insanely difficult task, and every baby in every household is going to do it that way, which is remarkable. Now, what I found is that having the context of how we originally learned how to move, given those parameters. So for instance, if we didn't have gravity holding the baby's head down, it wouldn't know how to, it wouldn't innately organize the rest of its body to apply enough force into the ground to pick the head up. So because of the like endogenous parameters, the arms, the trunk, the legs and head, like we develop in a way to go through these patterns a certain way because These are the tools we got to do it, which are ultimately going to help us survive. And there's something magical about reconnecting as an adult to that process, that developmental sequence, the things that go down in the first year of our life. And I've seen these stages broken down differently. I think there's different philosophies. You know, I remember when you were at the gym, we spoke a lot about five patterns: rolling, crawling, walking, hinging, squatting. There's a school of thought called dynamic neuromuscular stability that breaks it down by months. It's all super useful. There's organizations like Original Strength that find really creative ways to practice some of these things. There's organizations like MoveNet. There's all these organizations that and philosophies that in some way are kind of reconnecting with some like raw version of movement before there were like adult rules. It was just like, watch what babies do and let's do some of that. Like that hardware and software is still in us and there's value in that. And especially when you look at a goal of being ultimately in a place where you can rely on your body to carry you through life the way you want. So if your body is essentially a vessel for the you that's inside somehow, this you that even though is ever changing, there's something constant in there that's you. And I don't know, I'm not going to pretend to know how to define what that is, but 10 years ago, there was still you in there, even though you were a whole different set of cells and such. So we want this body to be able to provide utility and being able to like move what I would say well, which you could call like have a high quality of movement, competency of movement. You could assign whatever like adjective you want to it. Being able to navigate your body in space, given those parameters in a way that you don't like cause pains and aches and injuries is super useful. And then on top of that, you could put all kinds of other qualities. Like you could get really strong. You could build muscle. You could build a lot of endurance or capacity. You could apply those to more specific things or play or like tasks, whether it's gardening or chopping wood or, you know, household chores or whatever. Or, you know, of course, the whole world of sports and activities related to that could all be piled on top of this. And one of the people I was lucky enough to stumble upon that we spent a lot of time talking about over the years was Gray Cook, which was one of the founders of the Functional Movement Systems, which discussed this like pyramid and how at the bottom of the pyramid, you could have this base of competency, this like, how well do you move? And then on top of it, you could put some additional transfer of force in the form of like strength or power. And that could all be expressed through the top of the pyramid, which would be some skill. And that could be an activity in the gym. It could be a backflip. It could be rolling a bowling ball, whatever the thing is. And what was important that he stressed was the shape of the pyramid, that you always want to make sure you had enough competency to support the strength or power that you're expressing through whatever that activity or skill is. And that's really useful. Like you've mentioned, you know, you go down these rabbit holes of obsession or whatever, and then eventually you get hurt. So if the amount of force that you push through your system is greater than the competency that could support it, it's not if, it's when. You're going to get some kind of signal from your body. And if you have the self-awareness, hopefully you'll be able to listen to that signal. Oh, yeah. Put my hand too close to the fire. You know, I got a signal. Unfortunately, a lot of people aren't good at listening to their body. They're not good at listening. They're just unpracticed at listening to pains or listening to certain cravings and what they might mean. So I guess that's a basic context of like, we want the body to take care of ourselves. And there's certain qualities that we can cultivate with this meat suit to help be a useful vessel for the thing that's inside of us that wants to do the things like hang out with our great grandkids or whatever down the road. So given that context, it's, you know, based on how much time you have, you could get so carried away of, well, how do I apply this into some kind of routine? Because it's so, there's so much individual variability, not just in the time you're willing to put in, but like what's your stress resilience? How much can you actually handle? And what you can handle now might be different than you could handle a year ago. I mean, stress comes in all kinds of ways, but I know from personal experience, family stress will dramatically affect how much exercise my body could handle. So being able to be aware of like what's right for me now, knowing that it's a fluid formula, like it's going to continually change. You're always going to be in some form of transition, is also very useful to take into account. That being said, with the new year, the first thing that I would recommend is mentally just kind of connecting with why you want to do any of this stuff, like why your health might be important to you. And this is an overlooked thing. I mean, when we go through school, they don't talk about this stuff. It's funny because when you get into the world as an adult and like and have to work like jobs, the corporate world does this shit all the time. It's like forecasting. You know, we did 50 million in sales last year. Our plan is to do 60 million this year. Okay, well, that means we have to open 4 more offices. We need 4 managers. We need 24 people that do this job or whatever. We need to make this many sales calls. Like, we're taught in the work field to think about the downstream outcomes we're looking for and then like work backwards of what that means we do today. But for some reason in fitness, even though so many people have some experience with fitness related things, it's very rare to have someone help you forecast down the road like that. So connecting with the why, and I feel that the easier that you connect with why you want to do any of that stuff, it's a lot easier to do the things today that lean in that direction. Like, you get rid of a lot of mental chatter and internal conflict that will create, you know, we'll be debating with ourselves. Should I, I don't want to go to the gym. I should go to the gym. I don't want to, like, we have all these narratives in our minds spinning around our head. But if you're really clear on why you go to the gym, a lot of that stuff will just kind of melt away and your behaviors become more matter of fact. And it's like, I'm the kind of person that goes to the gym because ... And a good thing to, one framework to think about when you're thinking about what you why is like, what do you really want down the road? Like, what are the most important things to you? Ultimately, the most important things in our lives for most people are generally our relationships. And your relationship with others and your environment is dependent on your relationship with yourself. But if you connect with those others, because that's what life's really about, it's your loved ones, your future generations that you want to be there for, like, those make exercise so much easier. Like, I find it personally inspiring when I see like an old person that's taking care of themselves, and they don't have to, I'm not talking about like some bodybuilder looking people.
Right.
I mean, someone that like can enjoy gardening, can enjoy picking up their grandkids at band practice or whatever when their kid needs them, and it's something that you could just flow through life and do because you want to do it. When you connect with those things, when you think of you want to be able to play with your grandkid, or even better, your great grandkid, maybe, like whatever that why is. And I'm not trying to impose my why on y'all. Whatever the downstream thing is, just connecting with it, like thinking about it, maybe even visualizing what that would look like. What do you physically have to probably look like to be able to do that? You know, and then that just makes it easier. So taking the time to connect with your why would be one. Do you want me to go through all three, or do you want to take one and we'll go back and forth?
Yeah, I'll take one. But no, you mentioned that there might be some differences. It's funny because that's the first one on my list too, is to find out your why. Because, I mean, it's so important for the reasons that you mentioned, but also too, like, people don't think about what happens when you reach the goal. So like, let's say your why is I want to lose 10 pounds for a wedding. Okay. Well, you've lost the 10 pounds for the wedding. Now what? And if your why isn't like this overarching theme of like you mentioned, maybe you want to be strong and for your family and your elderly years, or maybe there's a special activity that you really enjoy, like say pickleball or something. And so you're just trying to stay moving for that. If your why is just some, you know, short-term goal, then oftentimes they'll reach the goal and then they'll quit. And then thus begins the entire cycle of, you know, stopping and starting. Same thing as like yo-yo dieting and all that stuff. So I fully agree with that. I think that's extremely important. One thing that you touched on is movement competency. So the pyramid from Gray Cook. And yeah, man, I definitely still hold a lot of the same philosophies that we had at CoreWorks. I think those are like underlying, it's the foundation, just like the pyramid. And then I kind of find more utility with placing more of a focus on building muscle, getting a little bit stronger. Like those things kind of matter to me a little bit more. For example, like you mentioned the asymmetry thing, doing like a single leg deadlift. And of course, there's going to be an asymmetry there. You're not going to hit symmetry. And so you can kind of go into this rabbit hole of working too long on that, where that time could be better spent just picking up something heavy, you know, just getting a little bit stronger. Like, sure, work on that, and but don't spend too much time on it, you know. And I've definitely fallen into that trap with a lot of things where it's like I'll spend 30 minutes working on something, and you know, that's time that I could have just picked up the weight, you know, put a weight in your hands and do a single leg deadlift. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's good. I think one thing, so my actual point is to do what you like to do. Find something that you like to do. So adherence is probably the most important thing for people to have any sort of longevity with health and fitness. You have to find something that you enjoy. Now, that's not to say you don't still work out, but if you can find an activity like, say, dancing, if you really like to dance, if there's like a local Zumba class that you really like to go to, and that motivates you to actually get off your butt and get to the class and move your body, fantastic. That's amazing. You really like pickleball? Amazing. Go play pickleball. That being said, use that. This goes back to the why point. If you can find an activity that you really like, that can start to become your why. So if you really like pickleball, well, I would hope that in your spare time, at least you're exposing yourself to some lateral movement. So like pickleball is blowing up right now, and it's no slouch of an activity. Like it's very fast movements, left to right. Most people go from a sedentary life. They hear about pickleball because their friend told them, and they're like, hey, I'll go with you next week. So they go from absolutely nothing to pickleball, and then they blow their knee out, or they tear their Achilles, or something weird happens. So if you can find an activity that you really enjoy and then apply the framework that Les was talking about, where you have that pyramid base of movement competency. And it doesn't have to be as granular as him and I are talking about right now, but you could view strength training as sort of the base for you being able to play pickleball or you being able to play Zumba. So it's like, go to a Zumba class twice a week, do a little bit of strength work twice a week. And I think that to me, that motivates me, because what I'm thinking about in my, I want to have a large library of ways of expressing my body. And the more things I practice, the more weights I pick up, the more running I do, the more just random activities that I do, I'm constantly exposing myself so that if I have a friend that asks me, hey, do you want to go do this thing with me? I'm like, sure. And I don't think about it. I'll tell you, give you an example. There's a, have you heard of F3? There's like a men's group. So they're all around the country. And I found one, it's right down the street from me. They meet at the local park, like it's like a mile away. I could run there. And, you know, it's at any given moment, there could be 20 guys that are meeting up. And it's just men's group that are, they care about fitness and they just do workouts together first thing in the morning, Saturday mornings. And so I went and, you know, there was running and there was core work. And like we were running around this school track and we were doing all these different exercises and stuff. I didn't have to worry, you know, am I about to get myself into something that's going to mess me up? Because I have the confidence of that foundational layer of that movement competency that Les was talking about. I know that there's probably not going to be very many things here that are outside of my foundation. And so that was a really great experience. I had a blast with those guys. Everyone's working hard. It was like age range. There was a 14-year-old kid there and there was a 70-year-old man there. And it was really great. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. And so that's kind of like the big thing for me to try. Just on the adherence part, because I think so many people start and they stop, and it's because they get, like running, for example. How many people do you know that started running and they're like, I hate running? And it's like, well, tell me about your first experience. And they're like, I ran this fast, I got out of breath, I felt really bad, and then I stopped, right? And that happens all the time. And I think that happens in exercise too, not just running, but like strength training and all that stuff where, you know, people watch a YouTube video and they just dive right in. They don't really think twice about it. And then they stop. And it's like, if you can find something that you really enjoy, that's moving your body, that's getting you winded, making your heartbeat, getting a little bit of a sweat, and you enjoy that, and then use that as your framework as I am aimed at this thing now, and I'm going to strength train to push towards that thing. I think that can be a powerful motivator to keep people in the game for a long time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, just to elaborate a little bit more too. You mentioned, you know, people, if they have like a short-term goal and they reach it, it's like, now what? But also, like, if you don't reach it, you could create this sensation that this like temporary sense of failure that was totally unnecessary. Like, you're not a failure because you didn't reach it. It's not like a true thing that now you are a failure because you missed. So it's like, it's unproductive. But so, and you go say that with anything. Like, anytime the goal, it's the goal is useful, but the attachment to the goal is not useful. So if you're focused heavily on reaching the outcome, you're setting yourself up to be disappointed for a number of reasons, create new suffering between your left and right ear that didn't need to be there, create injuries too. I mean, for instance, let's say you did a dozen pull-ups when you were in college, and then you're back in the gym and you're like, you know, 40 years old, and you're like, well, I could do one pull-up, but I used to be able to do a dozen, so I want to get back into it, so I'm going to work at it. And then you just start grilling away on pull-ups, trying to get back to the old college self, which is an illusion, because now you're 40. And if you're attached to that idea of hitting 12, you're less likely to be a good listener. So, like, let's say you're on rep 6, and you feel this little twinge in your shoulder. You're less likely to pay attention to that because you want the goal. You're attached to that outcome. So you fight through another couple reps, both which now increase the damage you've just created. And then 2 days later, you're back in there and you're like, I'm pretty sure it's fine now. I'm just going to go back at it. And then eventually you're not doing any pull-ups because you're in physical therapist's office or your orthopedic surgeon's office. It's like, and you got rehab, and it's like all because you had an attachment. Whereas if you thought of it more long term and more as a process to embrace, it could be like, well, I know I want to be stronger so that I could, you know, be strong in my older years and take care of myself. And along the way, I'm going to practice pull-ups as a strength exercise. And then you could say, well, how should I practice pull-ups in a way that nourishes my body and cultivates strength so that one day I know that my body is there for me when I need it? And then you're more likely on that fifth rep to be like, I'm not sure I could do another 6-1. I'll give it 5 minutes and try again. Or like, and you don't make a dumb decision. And that, you know, it's like the more you pay attention to what's really important to you, because the 12 reps isn't really that important. Like, nobody's life changes off of that. Yeah. But if you could be there for a loved one when you're old and not have a busted up shoulder, and you could like help them with something that requires a shoulder, like, that's meaningful. But it's hard to do. And, you know, no matter how much you practice that, you could still get off course, and that's fine. But what you practice grows stronger. So if you practice paying attention to what your goals are and what's driving you, you'll get better at making good decisions based on those. You'll get better at that whole process.
True.
The other thing, I guess number two for me, movement based, I would say something that I think is just way underrated is just walking, like taking a walk, ideally every day, or is, you know, if not every, almost every day walk. I don't even think it has to be that long. I mean, I think walk for 5 minutes, turn around, walk 5 minutes to get back. I think words can't really describe well the far-reaching benefits of what you can get from a walk. And it's odd how few people walk. And this might be variable to different locations. Some areas are just more active areas. Like, I know we've talked when you moved down to Carolina and you talked about how cool it was that so many people were active. I mean, I live in a fairly dense suburb. And, I mean, you'll see, like, 5 people walking a day. But there's 200... So you're like, in my neighborhood, there's a few dozen houses and there's like 3 people, maybe 4 people that walk regularly. It's like,
it's weird.
So many people missing out.
Sorry to cut you off. The place that I just moved to last year, there's a really wealthy neighborhood down the street. And I don't know what it is about this place, but
you just zoomed in
on me. Sorry.
It's wild.
I'm right here. There we go. Hang on a second.
What, do you have an AI camera that's following you around?
Yeah, I do.
No way.
Sorry about that.
I'm glad I don't have one of those.
Yeah, I got to figure out how to. There we go.
Oh, wow. You're just motioning your hands to.
There we go. Here I am, big guy. Here I am, big guy. Okay. All right. Get it together. Anyways, sorry about that. There's a neighborhood. Let me not put my hand in the frame anymore. And yeah, there's a bunch of houses out there. Very wealthy neighborhood. And I'll go out there on a weekend because there's a greenway right down the street from it. And there's literally no one. And you see there's like kids' toys in the yard. Like, you know, there's people that live there. It's the weekend, so their kids are home. And there's absolutely no one out there walking or doing anything. It's like a ghost town. It's kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, and overall, the health benefits of it. I mean, just talking about the meat suit itself. I mean, you are working large muscle groups. It's great to do before, after a meal to help distribute and manage sugar, essentially, as it's being broken down. It propels the lymphatic system that will require muscular contraction, and especially from the lower legs, because you have a lot of lymph. It's liquid, it's heavy, and it's got to be pushed mechanically up your body. And the activation of your lower leg muscles just from walking helps support this very important, very overlooked system that operates as, on some level, a sewage system to get rid of toxic crap in your body. It helps you digest fats. It mobilizes immune cells and plays a big role in your overall immune function. And you got to move your body. You are the pump. Like, you got to walk. And then there's the other things, mentally and emotionally. I cannot tell you how many challenging things in my life I've worked through on walks that without the walk, you just wouldn't have like the space to do it. Like, you're not working out, you're not working through some serious issue in your life while you're on your phone or watching TV or whatever. And, you know, if you meditate, great. Most people don't, but there's like a, like, that could be your meditation, like just going for a walk. And yeah, it's all, you could also multitask. You could learn, you could have like a podcast in your ear or some educational YouTube content or your favorite book or whatever. But just letting your mind wander, or like listening to music, something where your head doesn't follow, and just seeing what arises. And you'll be amazed at the things that you could work out in your life by just taking 10, 15 minutes to go on a walk. And it's generally, you know, free. So I think that is, for most people, just really low hanging fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever heard of EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing?
I did. I interviewed on my podcast a woman that specializes in that. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Super interesting stuff. For those that don't know, essentially when you're walking, your head is slightly moving left to right. You don't really notice it, but as your eyes are fixated on something, let's say, you know, 50 feet down the trail, there's a tree and you just happen to be staring at it. And the subtle movements of your body moving left to right make your eyes move because your eyes are fixated, right? So if one part's moving, the other part has to be moving too. And I guess it's simulating, if you can think about a stressful event during that slight movement, it's telling your nervous system that you're moving towards something as opposed to moving away from something. So it can help kind of like mitigate that flight response. I mean, you said you do a lot of your thinking, and I do too, very similarly. Like, I've thought through some of my worst moments where it's like something that really triggers me, but for whatever reason, if I think about it when I'm walking, it's like a totally different process for me. Like, it's I'm actually able to think logically, and it might just be the fact that I'm moving my body as well, you know, which is going to be helpful for that. But like, it's very difficult to think through something stressful when you're just sitting around. And you have this like energy that's like pent up, you know what I mean? So I think that's great.
Yeah. It also, I mean, it doesn't have to be alone too. I remember the year leading up to my youngest child going away to college, we started walking after dinner 6 days a week, very regularly. This was in the beginning of the whole COVID thing. And I'm so glad we had that time. I mean, I went on 300 some walks with my, at the time, you know, 17, 18 year old daughter, and priceless, you know, all the good conversations we're on those that we've had in our life are on those walks. Yeah. So it's a way to connect with others too and talk about the ultimate multitask. You know, do something that nourishes your body, your soul, your mind, your emotional health, and your relationship with someone you deeply care about. What's better? That's probably more advantageous than anything you could do in a gym with any trainer, whatever. And it's available.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think that's such a huge take home as well. Like last Thanksgiving. So I tell my clients now on holidays, like eat your dinner. And then instead of everyone just sitting around and getting drunk and all that stuff, like ask everyone, like, who wants to go for a walk? And last Thanksgiving, I did that. I asked my mom. She was like, yeah. And sure enough, everyone came. And it was awesome. And we had just a big old group out at like 7 p.m. just walking the neighborhood, you know. And so it's like, it's easier than you think to get people to come with you, you know, as long as you're not like, hey, let's go walk 2 miles. Like, okay, calm down there, guy. But no, it's good, man. So far, we have find your why. We have find something you like. And then Les's last point was take walks. And I think those are all good. My second point would be journaling. So I'm sure most of you know, I have ulcerative colitis. And so journaling has been, pain journaling, food journaling has been paramount for me, sort of figuring out my triggers and trying to heal myself. Essentially, you know, I'm on a never ending, you know, colitis is not a curable thing. All you can do is sort of improve as much as you can. And as Les said, stress can be a big trigger. I mean, when my colitis was at its worst, 2022, actually, when I came down and saw you, and I was very thin, I lost a lot of weight. So when I saw you, I was 167 pounds. I was actually going through a really bad flare up because I was going through a breakup with my ex. And man, that affected me in a really big way. And so like I was having a really hard time keeping weight on no matter how much food I was eating. I was eating a lot. And so luckily I've been able to get that stuff under control, but it's like, it's only through journaling, taking note of the things that are affecting me in certain ways that I've been able to get back to. So I'm 183 pounds now, feel so much better. But journaling for health and fitness, you learn a lot about yourself. So, you know, well, so we'll start off with lifting. So journaling, I think, is important for lifting because one of the biggest things is progressive overload. If you don't write down what you're doing in the gym, then how do you know when you're improving? How do you know when you can celebrate? How do you know if you're progressively overloading? I see a lot of people, there's a saying going around now, are you exercising or are you training? And I think if people can not obsess about it, but sort of shift their mindset into training a little bit, where they're kind of thinking about it from the lens of, am I just doing the same thing every time? Or am I like actually improving here? Maybe the weight goes up by 2 pounds, you know, after 4 weeks at the same weight, or maybe I can get 10 squats with, you know, whatever, if you're doing a goblet squat with, we'll say 80 pound dumbbell or something, and maybe you're getting 10 reps now instead of 9. Just little things like that, I think, are important for one, your muscular and strength development, but also for celebrating, because I do think it's important to celebrate your wins. And I've had to kind of push some of my clients, hey, celebrate that, where they'll, you know, they'll lose 0.8 of a pound for a week. That's actually really good. Like, you don't want people to lose 5 pounds each week. You know, if they're really overweight, they could, you know, get away with that a little bit easier. But, you know, if they're just 40 pounds overweight or so, you want to try and preserve as much muscle mass as possible. And so in their eyes, they're like, oh, I lost 0.8 of a pound. It wasn't 1.5, like you said, because I kind of say like 1.5 to 2 pounds. I'm like, hey, we're not looking for perfection here. Like you had a loss and 0.8 is actually pretty sizable. So you should celebrate that. And they're like, oh, okay. It's like, yeah, you know, like these are good things. And it's the journey of health and fitness is like an up and down roller coaster all around. It's never perfectly linear. And so writing stuff down can help you keep things in context. On that point, I think it's also important to help you understand objectively that you are making progress, because a lot of times people can look back at they can look at themselves in the mirror and maybe they're bloated that day. Maybe they had a high sodium meal the night before, or, you know, any number of reasons they could be bloated. So they look at themselves and they're like, like I'm not really liking the way that that's looking right now. But if you have objective things that you've been tracking over time, then at least you know the trend is on the right track and it can stop you from getting discouraged. And then the last point is just sort of tracking, how do I feel? Maybe there's a little nagging knee thing or a lower back thing. And obviously the pain point is very huge for being able to exercise. You will inevitably hurt a little bit. There's going to be days where you just wake up and you're just you're inflamed for whatever reason, things just don't feel right. And it's important to know why. Go back, look at what you ate. Maybe you didn't sleep well. Like, there's any number of things that you can write down. So typically when I wake up, the first thing I write is, how did I sleep? How do I feel? How does my back feel? Because that's my lower left side, you know, it could act up really bad out of nowhere. I could go to bed feeling great, wake up and feel like I deadlifted 800 pounds and my back is completely out for no reason. And so keeping track of those things helps me to go back and, you know, see what is causing this, you know? And then also, obviously, people talk about journaling for your mental health. I think that's just as important as all this other stuff as well, because, how do you feel? How are you doing? You know, I think Les mentioned stillness earlier, and I think a journal is a great way of kind of dipping your toe into stillness in a lot of ways, because it's hard to be still without something physically in your hands, like just sitting there and staring at the wall or just sitting there and closing your eyes. It can be really uncomfortable for a lot of people. The voices in there start to get a little bit louder and it's not so pleasant. So having something physical to kind of go through those thoughts with, I think is really useful as well. So my thing is journaling.
Interesting.
What are your thoughts?
I think that you're going to inspire a lot of people to try to get ulcerative colitis if they know they can lose weight so easily with it.
Don't do that, people. Don't do it. I know people are like, wow, he lost so much weight. That's all they hear.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. And I on the topic you just said, I look at things a little bit differently, and I'm probably not as good at like celebrating wins. I think what you mentioned is a fantastic way, and I think people thrive with different strategies and they learn different ways. For a lot of my people that come in over the years that are very driven and they really care about those objective numbers, sometimes I will try to promote, I don't want to say the opposite, but a different take where you're, because you have that attachment. If you're like a type A or driven person and you're very unpracticed at letting go of those attachments, I try to encourage people to just practice. And if you have connected with the why successfully, the joy of that practice will generally emerge. Like, this is your practice today. This is how it feels. Now, granted, I might get different outcomes from that. Like, you're shredded. I'm not. So,
thanks.
So, you know, my relentless progressive overload or whatever, absolutely useful. And also can be stressful for some people, and for some people, not something that would interfere with them, but it might be something to where their why could get a little misaligned of what they really care about, because you could get hung up on like, well, I did 185 last week, and why does 175 feel heavy this week? I should be able to do 190, and like create all the stories instead of like, you know, check with how you feel. Like, how'd that rep feel? Like, there's a lot of ways to get better, too, that don't show up in the journal.
Man, it's so funny. You thought we were going to be different, but I mean, on this point, we're a little bit different, but that's something that I was thinking about, too. Go for it. Sorry to interrupt.
Like, I mean, you could do, let's say you're doing a lift, and let's say you get a good number, and it beat the last week's number. And also, maybe that was, like, the difference of you're not sleeping as well that night because of how stressful it was to get that number or something. So I just think it's important to like also listen, no matter who your coach or trainer is, you are your best advocate. And it takes practice to listen to how you feel from day to day and pay attention. With the journaling thing, I mean, I wish I could read my own handwriting. I would journal more, but that's something where with the food stuff, I probably could have done myself a good service by being better about journaling, especially it seems like with food, there's so much individual variability of like what foods serve different people differently. And the timeline on when you're affected is different also and for different foods. So it could be really muddy information to try to figure out in your head. But if you have a log and you can go back and say, oh, like, because it might be like on some foods a 24 or 48 hour delay before you have an issue. So it's like if you're not journaling, that might be really hard to pick up on. And if what you're eating serves you and you feel great, you know, that's probably not necessary to do a food journal. But if you're trying to navigate something like you're talking about, you know, having some intestinal inflammation, if you feel like your intestines aren't optimal, there's a lot of value in uncovering the things that are interfering with that intestinal health and supporting it, because it does seem like your overall health is generally limited by the health of your intestines, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you said something to me a long time ago that stuck with me, something along the lines of, like, if you end up with acne, like, what does that say about what's going on inside of your gut? You know, because essentially, like, if you think about what acne is, well, it can be all kinds of different things. But like, if someone has relatively clear skin and then the next day they have like 3 new pimples that just emerge out of nowhere, to me, that's like a detoxification pathway where it's trying to perhaps purge something out of you. And maybe some of the other methods aren't being utilized. Maybe you're not sweating enough, or maybe your digestive system is screwed up, so it can't get it out that way. And so it's finding some other means of getting it out. So I think, yeah, man, it's funny you say the success thing and how, you know, getting a test of numbers, because I totally agree with that. And I wrote down success isn't just the numbers, you know, and just elaborate on that a little bit. Like, it could be, you know, so for example, I did some Romanian deadlifts over the weekend, and I do like really long sets because I'm limited to what I have here in my office. And so, you know, I can't go any heavier, so I just do as many reps as I can. And I'll add a weight vest on top of it too. And man, when I first started doing that, I was incredibly lightheaded, like to the point where I would finish the set and I would immediately have to sit down because I'm like, oh shoot, like I'm fighting for my life here. And then over the weekend I did it and I felt fine.
Oh, interesting.
And I was barely out of breath, you know, and that's something I noticed, like, that's interesting. You know, like, is my heart healthier?
How long of a set are we talking about here, Randall?
I mean, 25 reps with, you know, 100 and what did that be? So with 150, 100, almost 160 pounds. So it'll get you, man.
It sounds like you need a gym membership. You got to get a little more weight.
I do, but sometimes it's nice to just be, you know, I can just,
yeah, I get it.
You know, drink my coffee, work out real quick, and then do whatever, you know, but yeah.
Yeah. The food thing, there's always so much, you know, the food thing's been so hard to figure out too. And it's such a big aspect. I mean, out of all the things that interact with your health, like of all the dials that we could tinker with, whether it's food or exercise or sleep, like, Grant, well, nothing's probably more impactful than sleep. Like, for instance, if you sleep 4 hours a night and then all of a sudden it goes to 8, nothing's going to help more than that. Yeah. But aside from like dramatic changes, whether you're deficient in sleep and then getting some, like the food is this lever that has a very fast impact on you. Like exercise, the results come slowly. At first, sometimes they come pretty quick, but it's very subtle. Like you're, you know, 1% better here, 2% better this month, generally, especially if you're experienced. But the food, it's like if you eat food that's bad for you and you eat, like, you could know pretty soon. Or if you, more importantly, stop eating something that's problematic for you, like your life could get a lot better really fast. It's a very powerful lever. And we've been thrown out so much information. I mean, I'm so gullible. I've been sucked along to all the fads along the way. All, you know, I've tried all the diet of the year type things. And something that I've luckily came upon over the last few years, studying more like this bioenergetic model of health in regards to food, especially, that I was missing for a long time, that now I see is really helpful for a lot of people. And I think it has to do with the stressful lifestyle that people have, is the value of carbohydrate. And I think a lot of people in the fitness like realm have been sucked into, preached like this low carb lifestyle as being the answer to so many things. And I think it can be really useful for a lot of people, but for a lot of people, even if it is useful, it's useful until it isn't. Like, things go well until they don't. And yes. And one of the things that was an eye-opener for me, like, I used to think low carb meant way less carbs than it actually means. Yeah. But if you talk to like a dietitian, they look at 40% carbohydrate as a low carb. Like, that's glorious news. And I think they're right. And I was like, for a long time, against that. And one thing I've come to realize is that a lot of our stress hormones, which I think a lot of people are just, I don't want to say they're living on, but most adults today go through life with stress hormones, I would say, elevated more than what's optimal for them, to be general about it. Most people have more stress than is what's best for them. Yeah. And it comes in many ways, but one of the ways it comes in is not having enough sugar, because your body runs on glucose, and it can run on a lot of stuff, but it likes glucose. And the average person's going to run on about 150 grams of glucose, whether you eat it or not. And if you don't eat it, it's going to make it. But that is inherently stressful and modulated by stress hormones, which is great to help you survive a stress. Like, our body is amazing and has all these elegant mechanisms to help you survive and navigate the providing of energy to meet the demand of energy. But chronically, we all know, we've all kind of heard that chronic stress is bad. Well, waking up and having no sugar in your body because you've been asleep and you haven't eaten, and then going out for a hard workout and then getting 70 grams of carbs later that day, even though you're craving them and trying to like keep them from you and fighting through those cravings, is stressful. And a lot of those hormones are activated when sugar is low, when carbohydrate is low, which on the flip side allows carbohydrates and sugar to directly suppress stress hormones. So to put it generally, sugar is anti-stress. And
there's a bunch of people screaming at their screens right
now. I'm telling you, I vilified sugar for so long. That term, that sentence was an absolute mindfuck for me for a long time.
Yeah.
But I am now convinced. I've seen enough people be able to modulate their stress with carbohydrates, and surprisingly, with sugars that some people think are like the not good sugars, like sugars that are easily to digest, where when you eat sugar, you quickly can use that sugar, because that's what you want. You want that glucose to get in the mitochondria to make abundant energy so that your hormonal system could say, oh, hey, we don't need to turn these stress switches on. We have what we want. And, you know, that is going to be dependent on your activity level and your stress level. But I feel like a lot of people that are walking in the door to see a personal trainer to make up for the fact that they're at a desk 40, 50 hours a week, and they're not just at a desk, they're problem solving. Even if you love your job, chances are it's stressful. Then they're navigating all the other activities in their life outside of those times. They're in a potentially stressful environment just because of all the crap that humans have, you know, put into everything, whether it's the water supply, the air supply, the food supply. It's hard to expect yourself to be hormonally balanced and happy and optimal in this world.
The real world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
this is stressful.
Yeah. And then we're staring at a screen. And then you throw on exercise, which is inherently stressful.
Yeah.
So I personally have found that using carbohydrate to support not just my workouts, whether it's having them in the system and ready to be used prior to a workout, so not just like 10 minutes before, but you know, hour before, hour and a half or something, or replenishing after a workout, has been really useful. Something that I used to fight against and not really be able to recognize my own cravings and what they actually meant. And to just help modulate my overall stress. And I feel like my stress resilience has gotten better. Like, I'm just not negatively affected by things that used to be, because my body is like more content with what it has for substrate. It has more energy sources available any given moment. Yeah. And it, you know, hasn't given me diabetes, contrary to belief. You know, carbs don't cause that inherently. And doesn't mean that all sugar, I'm not saying all sugar and carbs are good. Like, the world is full of all kinds of junk, but in general, carbohydrate can be very supportive, especially if you have a stressful lifestyle, which I think in general is most people.
Yeah. No, I think you're bringing up a really good point. And to that point, you know, your brain uses 40% of the glucose that comes into your body. And it's like, even before this conversation, so I think what Les is talking about is like being strategic with your carbohydrate intake, because obviously you could smash 100 grams of carbs in the form of pasta and you're probably not going to feel so good. But if you limit it to 20 to 40 grams of, you know, fruit or fruit juice, honey, things of that nature, you can use it strategically. So for breakfast, I had just some lean ground beef and some eggs. And then 30 minutes before this conversation, I had some juice because I knew that this was going to be an interaction that I had to be sharp for. And as to his point about the stress thing, I probably would have felt a lot more stressed out if I was in ketosis right now or if I was fasted. Oh, you know, sure. My body would be panicking, trying to do what it can, you know. But it's interesting you say that, too, because I do have this on my list a little bit. You know, luckily, I've been able to not get swept away so much. The temptation has been there, but I've had to convince quite a few people that are on like the carnivore train and all that stuff of like, not convince, but just try to advocate for carbohydrates a little bit more, because they think, oh, you eat carbs, you get fat. And I'm like, well, why am I not fat then? Because I eat 300 grams of carbs a day. Like, and so I think my point, this next point, so this will be number three for me, is the keto and the carnivore diet can be useful tools. I don't think that they're good long term, and I don't think that they're good to just dip your toe in. So when keto first exploded, I can't tell you how many times I heard someone that would be like, oh, I'm ketogenic right now, I'm doing the keto diet. And then you hang out with them on the weekend, they're getting blasted, shit-faced, right? and it's like, so I think so obviously there's ongoing debate on whether LDL cholesterol, which would be the bad cholesterol for those that don't know, if elevated LDL cholesterol is causative to cardiovascular disease. There's a massive debate on this. Where my mind goes is, even if there's a chance that it is causative, the last thing you want to be doing is adding alcohol. And, you know, on the weekends you eat cookies or something, so you fall off. It's like, oh, it's just one day. Let me, you know, I'm not going to think too much about it. When you have created essentially a hurricane environment in your blood, you know, where, let's say, for example, I like to use blood pressure as an example. If you get hammered on a Saturday, the next Sunday, you're not going to feel good. Your blood pressure will be pretty elevated. I mean, I venture to guess 30 or 40 points, maybe, who knows, depending on how bad it goes. But that blood being forced through your arteries is scraping off what's called the endothelium. And then your white blood cells, which they're responsible for all kinds of immune functions, but they come through and they gobble up dead tissues, essentially. And those are what's responsible for creating what are called foam cells or plaques. You've probably heard of plaques before. And so you've created this environment now where you have elevated LDL because you're on the ketogenic diet or you're smashing ribeyes, you're on the carnivore, and now your blood pressure is elevated and you've caused this damage to your arteries, and you run into an environment, you run into atherogenic environment where you're heading towards atherosclerosis, where hardening of the arteries, essentially. And so I think that's the trouble people run into when they dip their toe into it, as opposed to like fully committing. Like, if you're going to do it, great. Use it as an elimination style diet. Cut out all the stuff that you suspect. If it's carbs, cut out all the carbs, whatever. Do it for the short term. Slowly reintroduce foods back and see what was actually causing the problem, as opposed to staying on this thing for the rest of your life. Because I know you've interviewed Paul Saladino, and he's changed his stance. And if you can go back to some of his stuff, he was doing intense debates, talking matter-of-factly about how the carnivore is the best thing since sliced bread, and he's changed his mind. And he now eats fruit and honey. And, you know, to his point, he couldn't stay hydrated. No matter how many electrolytes that he took in, he found out that if he wasn't signaling insulin at the level of the liver, then it doesn't matter how many electrolytes that you're bringing in, you're just going to run into problems. And so I think, on to Les's point, like, not demonizing carbohydrates, seeing them as an ally, not only for your performance, for your stress levels, using diet strategically instead of, oh, this is going to make me shed 20 pounds of weight. Like, why am I actually using this diet? Is it a good long-term choice? Because I would say it's not. And I think there's way, we're basically running an experiment right now where there's right. millions of people on the carnivore diet. And we're going to find out in about 20 years, 20 to 30 years, what the result of that is. And like even sucralose, do you know anything about sucralose? Have you been paying attention to sucralose at all?
I don't eat that. I don't know much about sucralose. It seems like fake ass sugar. I'd rather just have sugar. I like right. organic cane sugar. I eat so much of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So to the keto point, you know, people are eating all these like ketogenic products that have
gotcha.
Sugar Weird replacement. Shit. So they have sucralose and stuff in it. Man, I just did a, it's not really a fact check, more of like an elaboration on, do you listen to Tim Pool at all?
I know of him. I don't really listen.
So he just blurted out one day that the origin of sucralose was that it was a pesticide. And I was like, what?
Really?
Hold on a second.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Right. So I did a little digging and he's partially right. So they weren't specifically using it as a pesticide, but they were looking for novel uses of sucrose derivatives. So sucralose is a chlorinated sucrose compound. Most pesticides are chlorinated compounds. And so the story is you had two scientists. One scientist said to the other, test it. The other scientist misheard him for taste it, tasted it, found out it was sweet.
That's
funny. And that's the story of sucralose, right? But no one can know for certain what they were actually testing. If it wasn't for food. And so we have this like mass experiment going on right now where people are mass consuming sucralose. Me, I was guilty. A month ago, I was smashing sucralose. And I started to connect the dots between some of my colitis symptoms and that. So I'm
interesting.
Cutting it out now. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it does not, your body can't process it.
Can I ask you,
Yeah.
If you're comfortable talking about this stuff, I mean, are there other common things, other foods that you know are likely to trigger your intestinal issues?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier that there might be foods that you think are good for you that might not be serving you. And that was exactly my experience. You know, I loved avocados, almonds, you know, those were two of my staples. And like, if you tell someone that, they'd be like, yeah, those sound like pretty healthy foods. Well, through food journaling, I started to realize, oh, every time I eat these things, some bad stuff happens. And I cut them out and it was instantly better. Now, I don't know if like maybe my body's ability to handle that much fat is impeded there, something to do with my bile production or any number of different things, but
could be the oxalates in the almonds. What I don't know what sure. avocado had. Is that avocado a FODMAP? It might be the fermentable fiber in it. I don't know.
I mean, it might be
high in FODMAPs. I'm not positive, but I think it might be.
Yeah. Perhaps. Yeah. I don't know. They're also very high in fat too. And I have noticed if I have a large bolus of fat, typically I'll run into issues. It's like, I don't know. Something with that, my body can't do much with it, but yeah, I mean, there's that apple, kiwis.
That's interesting because apples are high FODMAP and kiwis are high oxalate. Maybe there's a connection to those two things. Maybe.
Yeah, perhaps.
Journaling is, I could say, very useful. I mean, and that's where you're right. Those diets are tools. They are great ways to get a clean slate for a little bit and then to introduce and be like, can I tolerate this? And the interesting thing too, I've went through a big gut healing thing, and at one point I was super restrictive, and I've done the strict carnivore for a little bit, but in general, I've been really restrictive for many years, different periods. And what you can handle when your gut is impaired might be very different than what you can handle when your gut health is back up to speed. So something that doesn't agree with you now doesn't mean you can never eat it. Like your cells in your intestine are turning over pretty quick, which is great because when things aren't going well, you're often not that far away from having things much better if you could eliminate the thing that's insulting it. Now, unfortunately, it's not always a food thing that's insulting it. I mean, it could be, like you said, you had a flare up when you had a mental or emotional stress in your life. And that's a common Absolutely. Thing that people will talk about. I mean, more generally, if you zoom out, under stress, your body is going to prioritize certain systems over other systems. It's going to prioritize the things to keep you alive today, get sugar to the brain or whatever, energy to the brain, more so than things that you need for more long term, whether it be immune function or digestion or sexual hormones or things like that. So in general, when stress goes up, regardless of the form that it is, like stress and metabolism are inversely related when the stress is chronic. I mean, it's going to slow things down. It's going to impair function. And And, you know, that could be detective work, you know, finding what the problem is. And it can very well be something that's not diet related. It could just be like, because of the mental and emotional stress, your diet is problematic. But if you could get your nervous system to chill out, whatever, and manage that, then you might be able to resume that proper function of that, whether you know, the whole migratory motor complex or whatever aspect of digestion that you're missing.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think about that often. Like, is it just that I'm so stressed right now that I just can't handle avocados, something about avocados and almonds or something like that? And is it the case that if I, you know, because I'm go, go, go. I wake up at 4:30 in the morning and I'm just like, I just don't stop. And it's like, that's stress. Although I feel good while I'm doing it and I'm like bouncing around and doing all the things I need to do. It's stress. Like you said, like exercise is stress, all that stuff is stress.
Stress hormones can feel good. People like to go on a roller coaster and feel adrenaline.
Cortisol feels good. Yeah, absolutely. 100%. It fires your adrenals. You feel like a superhuman. You know what I mean? And so I was talking to Amelia, and she's a pro boxer in episode 2. We were talking about that, like intermittent fasting. When I was really fasting hardcore, I wake up at 3 a.m. and I would feel great. But I knew like, hey man, you should probably go back to sleep. But I couldn't. Like, it was just like my body was just in the sympathetic branch, just fight or flight for whatever reason. I'm just like, I was just wired. You know what I mean? And I just had a really hard time relaxing. So no, I'm with you on that.
Well, there's a lot there. Yeah, I mean, we can go on and on, but I think that's a really good place to start. You know, if someone's going into the new year and they're like, they want to have a pivot point, there's a few things to consider for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's in the pipe for the Mindful Movement podcast, YouTube channel, any new cool stuff?
Actually, we do have something really new. So the Mindful Movement, our main YouTube channel, which is my wife's guided meditations, which if you want to check out, have helped a lot of people. She has a, just a natural talent. She's an angel. She has a very nourishing, comforting voice and approach to guiding someone through, whether it's relaxation or hypnosis-based meditations to support managing stress, anxiety, or other more specific things. She also works one-on-one and does private hypnotherapy and coaching. And it's really a fascinating process, and she changes a lot of lives. And she just had her book come out that she's been working on the last year or two, just this week. So that's kind of exciting.
What's the book called?
It's called, I have it here.
Nice.
It's called You Are Not Broken by Sarah Raymond.
Nice.
A Compassionate Guide to Uncovering Inner Wisdom and Transforming Your Life Through Hypnotherapy. So my wife loves to do hypnotherapy one-on-one coaching sessions with that. But they are time consuming, and she doesn't have a lot of time. She also owns 2 brick and mortar Pilates studios. So, and she runs the Mindful Movement. So, this is a tool for those that want to be taking through her traditional process, but at a more self-paced thing on your own through a book format. So that's just available. So that's the newest thing. What else is new? That's it. I mean, locally, we have a new thing. We have a new Pilates studio that's inside the gym that used to work out. So if someone's out there and then they're in the Maryland area, you want to come in and say hello or get a training session or take a Pilates class, we have some of that stuff. New personally, more non-professional. I'm taking guitar lessons and playing and doing some woodworking, some amateur woodworking. And I've been trying to get better at hunting, but I still definitely suck at hunting. Cool. That's basically what's on the palette. So still working with people in the gym. I do work online with people. It's not my favorite way to work with people. I know you thrive on it. I think it takes different personalities to really embrace that. And maybe it's just because I'm old or something, but I don't know. I don't enjoy that as much as being in person with somebody. But still have some availability. So if people are local to the Maryland area and they want to try that. But I do also do it virtually, but it's not something I make a lot of time for. And then gotcha. I'm just doing the podcast. So I try to use the podcast as a tool to just empower folks to play a larger role in their sense of well-being, whatever that looks like. And that comes in many ways. And I just interview people that I generally want to talk to about, and I drag the audience along for the ride.
Yeah, I love it. Well, awesome, man. Once again, I appreciate you doing this, and you know, I appreciate all the different insights and arguments and discussions that we've been in throughout the. I mean, seriously, we're joking about it, but
if I had more really carbs back then, I probably wouldn't have been so argumentative.
Right, you would be so grumpy all the damn time.
Exactly. I really think that was playing a role in my grumpiness.
It's possible. Yeah. 100%.
Well, thank you for having me on. And I'm really excited to, you know, watch this next phase for you unfold with the podcast. It's long overdue. I know you've been thinking about it, and I'm glad to see you doing it. And you've been on the Mindful Movement podcast, and sure, we'll have you back on sometime, and we'll do this as a regular thing.
Word. Appreciate it, man. So thanks for watching. If you're still here, we appreciate it. And you are watching the Always Adaptive, listening to the Always Adaptive podcast. And you can follow me on social media at Always Adaptive on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, X, all of it. Just type in Always Adaptive and you'll find me there. I'll see you guys at the next one.
Have a good day, everyone.